If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hey guys, this right here is going to be the ACLS certification material for stroke. This is for the AHA's ACLS material. And just a little side note, the AHA branched off and created the ASA, or the American Stroke Association. Then that particular organization came out with their ASLS course, which is the Advanced Stroke Lifesaver course. It is unlike anything that you think it is. It is definitely not something that is just touched on about the NIH or a BFAST exam. It's an extremely in-depth and difficult course to complete. It's very good though, but for this particular material, I do not know if the AHA in the ACLS book covers the four types of stroke, but there are four types of strokes out there. You have two that are very well covered in nursing school, and then you have two that are not discussed hardly at all, and we're talking about in many medical educational materials. So you have your hemorrhagic stroke. The big thing to remember with the hemorrhagic stroke is the thunderclap headache. They're going to feel like, sometimes they can feel a pop in their head, and then the thunderclap headache, they just all of a sudden get that thunderclap headache. And a thunderclap headache is going to be the worst pain of their life, 20 out of 10 pain. They will be able to speak. They are oriented. They are able to walk. They have their balance. They have their gait. So, but it's that thunderclap headache, the 20 out of 10 pain, and it's a very big life-threatening emergency. And then you have your ischemic stroke. This is the one that everyone is very familiar with the left and right sided deficits. The big thing to remember about this is going to be your window for TNK/TPA. Something that they also may or may not cover in the manual is going to be the permissive hypertension. The permissive hypertension is the body's defense mechanism for protecting the brain's penumbra. With the penumbra, you're looking at a concentric circle looking thing in the brain tissue death. And so the closer that you go into the penumbra, that is where you start getting that ischemic tissue that is going to die off. And there's no it's irreversible. And then as you zoom out from the penumbra, you start getting into the salvageable material or the salvageable brain tissue. And so that permissive hypertension locks in that blood into the brain. That way it can utilize those resources to kind of help itself save that ischemic tissue in the penumbra that is salvageable. And so the biggest contraindication with that is going to be giving a blood pressure med to drop that blood pressure, because if you do, then you're basically starving the brain of all of that material that it was going to use, because you have an ischemic area and there's no blood able to get in there anymore. And so the blood that was there is now gone. And so now you've taken a big problem and made it worse. And so you're looking at like a 220 blood pressure is the highest that you want it to be. And or you're talking about like 120 diastolic, again, is like the maximum that you want to see. This is all before TPA, TNK. Now, when you give TPA, TNK, I think you're looking at wanting to keep the blood pressure under 185. But I can't remember right off the top of my head. Again, my certification's coming up due, so I'll figure it out here pretty soon. But that's the big thing with the ischemic stroke. You're looking at TPA, TNK windows, and then you're also looking at the permissive hypertension before TNK, TPA. Now, the two least common talked about strokes are going to be your cerebral stroke or cerebellar stroke. I'm sorry. It's a cerebellar stroke. And basically the big sign and symptom of that is the person was walking and then all of a sudden they lost their balance or they lost their coordination. It can also present as a like a visual field deficit as well. So, but normally the person's able to talk, the person's able to communicate. They are typically ANO times four. They're able to answer your questions. They lost their gait, they lost their balance. And so that's the big one for the cerebellar stroke. Now, the worst one, the worst stroke of all, and the one that they don't talk about most is going to be your brainstem stroke. If you have an ischemic area in this particular area of the brain, I mean, if you just think about the anatomy of the brain and how it is, everything kind of funnels down to the brainstem before it branches out into the brain or into the body. And so if you have ischemia in this particular area, you're looking at paralysis from the neck down. You're not going to have any function from the neck down, but you're still going to be able to feel everything from the neck down. And also you're not going to be able to communicate. You're going to lose your ability to phonate. So no phonation abilities. And then another thing is you're only going to be able to use your eyes. And so this leads to a syndrome like they call, it's like either entrapment syndrome, imprisonment syndrome, locked in syndrome, something like that. Basically a syndrome where it indicates that you're trapped inside your own body. And that is basically what it is. You're not able to control your mouth. You're not able to speak. You're not able to move your limbs. The only thing you can do is move your eyes, not even your head. So no function from the neck down with a brainstem stroke. So just to kind of recap everything, you have a hemorrhagic stroke with a thunderclap headache as the major sign and symptom. With the ischemic stroke, you're looking at left-right sided deficits. This is the stroke that we're all very familiar with and that they teach on a lot. And the big thing with that is that you have the penumbra and you have this idea of permissive hypertension. And then you also have TPA, TNK windows that you have to abide by along with the dosage requirements for those. And then you have the cerebellar stroke, which is that loss of balance, loss of gait, loss of coordination all of a sudden. And then you have the brainstem stroke, which is basically going to be paralysis from the neck down with the inability to communicate via voice or phonation. So it leads to that locked in or entrapment syndrome. Okay, so this right here is going to be everything AHA's ACLS stroke.
Patient's here.
Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
He's wearing it too. Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, was caved in, and she was hanging out parked in front of the window.
She was in an emergency room for
45 minutes of CPR. You can stop CPR.
6 over.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into really high-stakes stuff, acute stroke care within the ACLS guidelines. Our mission, as always, is that 80-20 rule, grabbing the vital 20% of info that gives you 80% of what you need. We're talking high-yield, testable, real-world ER knowledge.
Exactly. And it's critical because, you know, people often think ACLS, they think cardiac arrest first. But honestly, acute stroke, that's often the scenario demanding the absolute fastest, most complex decisions under pressure. So today we're zeroing in purely on that stroke timeline, the triage, the key decisions you got to make instantly based on the guidelines.
Time is brain, right? That phrase says it all. The clock starts the second those symptoms appear. And the real hook here, I think, is understanding that fundamental split.
Right.
We're basically racing against time to figure out if it's the 87% or the 13% type of stroke, because that single distinction, it changes absolutely everything that comes next.
Okay, let's kick things off with that split. The numbers themselves are the blueprint. Ischemic stroke, that's when an artery gets blocked, you know, by a clot accounts for, well, a huge 87% of all strokes. These are the patients where we can potentially intervene with treatments to open that artery back up, like clot busters or actually pulling the clot out.
87%. So the vast majority involve a blockage we might be able to fix.
Okay.
Which leaves the other 13% as hemorrhagic, bleeding in the brain.
That's right. And that smaller group, it breaks down further. Roughly 10% is bleeding within the brain tissue, intracerebral hemorrhage, and about 3% is bleeding around the brain, subarachnoid hemorrhage. And here's rule number one, absolutely non-negotiable. You have to burn this into your brain if it's hemorrhagic bleeding. Fibrinolytic therapy, the clot buster drug, is completely forbidden.
Right. Giving a clot buster to someone actively bleeding into their brain, well, that's a disaster.
Precisely. Catastrophic. So the whole system is geared towards getting the right patient to the right place fast. That starts with the stroke chain of survival, first link, rapid recognition, sudden weakness, trouble speaking or seeing, maybe a sudden severe headache, confusion, any of those flags.
And recognizing those symptoms has to immediately trigger the next link, right? EMS dispatch.
Yes. And crucially, EMS needs to notify the hospital before they arrive. That pre-hospital notification and triage piece is vital.
Okay, so let's zoom in on EMS in the field. What are their absolute immediate priorities according to the guidelines?
Well, obviously assess ABC's airway, breathing, circulation. But beyond that, two things really stand out. First, oxygen. Only give supplemental O2 if their saturation is actually low, like below 94%, or if you just don't know. No routine oxygen for everyone.
Okay, less than 94 or unknown sat. Got it. And the second thing.
Check the blood glucose. Always, always check it, because severe hypoglycemia, it can mimic stroke symptoms almost perfectly. You don't want to miss that.
Good point. Easy trap to fall into. But then there's the big one, the single most important piece of history.
Without a doubt, establishing the time of symptom onset, or what we call the last known normal time, LKN. This LKN is your time zero. It dictates the entire treatment pathway, especially eligibility for time-sensitive therapies like clot busters.
And what if they, say, wake up with symptoms? How do you handle LKN then?
That's the classic wake-up stroke scenario. In that case, the LKN defaults to the last time the patient was known to be awake and symptom-free. So if they went to bed fine at 10 p.m. and woke up with deficits at 6 a.m., their LKN is 10 p.m. If you can't pinpoint that LKN, you generally can't determine eligibility for IV thrombolysis based on time.
Wow. Okay, so that LKN is everything. Now, how does this connect to hospital triage? We hear a lot about different levels of stroke centers, primary, thrombectomy capable, comprehensive. What's that about?
Right, so not all hospitals are equipped the same. The key difference often lies in the ability to perform endovascular therapy, or EVT. That's mechanical thrombectomy, physically removing the clot. This usually requires specialized teams and equipment found at thrombectomy-capable or comprehensive stroke centers.
And EMS needs to figure this out in the field.
Ideally, yes, especially for suspected large vessel occlusions, or LVOs. An LVO means a blockage in one of the brain's major arteries, supplying a big territory. These often need EVT, so if EMS suspects an LVO using a field assessment tool, the protocols often direct them to transport the patient to the nearest appropriate center capable of EVT, even if it means bypassing a closer, non-EVT-capable hospital, as long as the transport time isn't excessive.
That's a huge decision made pre-hospital. Routing based on the suspected type and location of the clot really underscores why that pre-hospital notification is so critical.
Okay, patient arrives at the ED. Now the clock is really, really screaming. The first major hospital goal, get that initial neurologic assessment done, usually using the NIH stroke scale, and get the patient to the CT or MRI scanner within 20 minutes of arrival.
20 minutes from door to scan. That's incredibly fast.
Yeah.
Okay, algorithm time. Decision number one feels like the biggest branch point. Bleeding or not bleeding?
Absolutely. That's the first most critical question the imaging answers. The goal is to have that non-contrast CT or MRI interpreted within 45 minutes of ED arrival. If that scan shows any sign of hemorrhage, any bleeding at all, the answer is yes, it's bleeding. You stop right there regarding clot busters and pivot to hemorrhagic stroke management.
Okay, so yes to bleeding means stop. But if the answer is NO, no hemorrhage visible.
If NO hemorrhage, then you proceed down the ischemic stroke pathway. Now, you urgently need to answer decision two. Is this patient a candidate for IV alteplase, the fibrinolytic therapy?
And this involves checking a list of criteria, yeah. Right? Contraindications.
Exactly. Is the LKN within the appropriate time window? Typically 3 hours, sometimes extended to 4.5 hours for specific patients. Are there other contraindications, like recent major surgery, trauma, bleeding disorders, and critically, is their blood pressure controlled? We'll circle back to that, but it's a big one.
Assuming they meet the criteria, No hemorrhage, within the window, no major contraindications. Then what's the time goal for actually giving the drug?
The system benchmark is door-to-needle time. Goal: initiate that IV alteplaso infusion within 60 minutes of arrival for at least 85% of eligible patients. Think about it, like less than an hour to do the initial assessment. Get the scan, get it read, review all eligibility criteria, get the pharmacy to prepare the drug, and start the infusion. It requires incredible coordination.
60 minutes door to needle.
Mm.
Okay, now let's loop back to those LVOs, the large vessel occlusions. If someone's suspected of having an LVO, are they also considered for EVT, the mechanical clot removal? That's decision three, right?
Yes. If it's an ischemic stroke and there's evidence or high suspicion of an LVO in a proximal artery, then you absolutely evaluate for EVT. Often, IV alteplaza is still given if they're eligible and arrive quickly. The idea is drip and ship or giving ellipsis while prepping for the procedure. But EVT is the definitive treatment for many LVOs.
And the time window for EVT is different, isn't it? It's longer than for alteplase.
Much longer, potentially. While IV alteplaza is generally limited to 3 or 4.5 hours from LKN, EVT can be considered up to 6 hours based on core imaging. And in certain carefully selected patients, based on more advanced imaging, that window can be extended dramatically up to 24 hours from their last known normal.
24 hours, that's a game changer. Yeah. How do you decide eligibility that far out? What's the extra imaging needed?
That's where penumbral imaging comes in, usually CT perfusion or MR perfusion scans. These scans help determine if there's still a significant mismatch between the brain tissue that's already infarcted, dead, and the tissue that's critically ischemic but still potentially salvageable, the penumbra. If there's a large area of salvageable penumbra, even many hours out, the potential benefit of opening the vessel with EVT might outweigh the risks. That's how we get to that 24-hour window.
So the penumbra is the target brain tissue, struggling but not dead yet. And the goal times for EVT reflect that urgency too.
Right. The benchmarks are door-to-device time getting the thrombectomy device deployed, aiming for within 90 minutes for patients arriving directly at an EVT-capable center, or within 60 minutes of arrival for patients transferred in from another hospital. Speed is still paramount to save that penumbra.
All right, let's drill down on the key meds. Time for some memorization, starting with the big one. Alteplase, the IV clotbuster. Dose.
The dose you absolutely need to know cold is about 0.9 milligrams per kilogram of the patient's actual body weight. 0.9 milligrams per kilogram.
Okay, 0.9 mil just a kilo, but there's a cap, isn't there? A maximum dose?
Correct. Crucial point. The maximum total dose is 90 milligrams, regardless of how much the patient weighs. So if someone's weight calculation goes above 90 milligrams, you just give 90 milligrams.
Got it. Max 90 milligrams. And how is it actually given? You don't just push the whole thing at once, right?
No, definitely not. The administration is specific. You give 10% of the total calculated dose as an initial IV bolus, pushed over 1 minute. Then the remaining 90% of the dose is infused intravenously over the next 60 minutes.
10% bolus over a minute, 90% infused over an hour. Okay. And the time window again, standard versus extended?
Standard window within 3 hours of symptom onset, or LKN. The window can be extended up to 4.5 hours from LKN in some eligible patients, but the inclusion and exclusion criteria become stricter in that 3 to 4.5-hour time frame.
Why stricter? What's the concern in that later window?
Primarily, the risk of complications, particularly intracranial hemorrhage, increases slightly as more time passes from the initial vessel occlusion. So for that 3 to 4.5-hour window, patients generally need to be younger, often under 80, have less severe strokes initially, and not have a history of both diabetes and a prior stroke, among other criteria. It's about carefully balancing benefit versus that increased risk.
Makes sense. Okay, now for arguably the most critical safety check and a huge exam trap.
Yeah.
The absolute contraindications. When do you absolutely not give alteplase?
Number one, top of the list, always. Evidence of intracranial hemorrhage on the initial non-contrast CT or MRI, any bleed, even a tiny one. Alteplase is absolutely contraindicated, full stop.
That's the showstopper from the CT scan. What else?
Other major absolute contraindications include things like significant head trauma or a prior stroke within the last 3 months, a history of a previous intracranial hemorrhage at any time, signs of subarachnoid hemorrhage,
yeah,
active internal bleeding, and very practically, persistently severe uncontrolled hypertension despite treatment efforts.
Let's focus on that hypertension piece. It's not just a contraindication. It's something you have to manage before giving the drug, right? What are the BP limits?
Exactly. Before initiating alteplase, the systolic blood pressure must be lowered and maintained below 185 millimmHg, and the diastolic pressure must be below 110 millimmHg.
So if they arrive with a BP of, say, 2120, you can't just give the alteplase.
Absolutely not. You must actively treat the hypertension first. Halt the process, give antihypertensives, and only proceed with the alteplase bolus once the BP is safely below that 105-110 threshold.
And what meds are typically used for that rapid lowering?
The guidelines often list intravenous agents like labetalol, nicardicone, or potentially clevedetine as preferred options for their rapid onset and titratability. The key is getting that pressure down quickly but controllably before pushing the clot buster. #TagAndTwy. Nursing priorities and critical time management.
Okay, thinking about the nursing role and team coordination, success hinges on hitting those time targets. Let's quickly recap them from an operational standpoint.
Right. It's all about parallel processing and efficiency. Door to initial physician assessment, ideally within 10 minutes. Door to CT completion within 20 minutes. Door to CT interpretation within 45 minutes. And door to alteplase needle time within 60 minutes.
Those are demanding targets.
Yeah.
And the vigilance doesn't stop once the infusion starts, right?
Right.
What about post-treatment monitoring?
No, it's intense, especially blood pressure management. After alteplase is given, the BP goal actually becomes even tighter. You need to maintain systolic BP less than 180 mmHg and diastolic less than 105 mmHg for at least the first 24 hours after treatment.
Less than 180, no, no, 105 for a full day after?
Yeah.
That requires frequent monitoring. What about other meds? Things like aspirin or anticoagulants.
Huge safety point here. Yeah. Do not administer any antiplatelet agents like aspirin or anticoagulant agents like heparin for 24 hours following the alteplase infusion. The risk of bleeding is highest during this period, so you hold off on those meds.
And there's a mandatory scan later too.
Yes. A follow-up CT or MRI scan is typically required at 24 hours post-treatment before starting antiplatelets or anticoagulants, mainly to assess for any hemorrhagic conversion bleeding into the area of the stroke, even if the patient looks clinically stable.
Okay. One last point on general care. Glucose. The guidelines mention hyperglycemia. What's the key takeaway there?
Yeah. Elevated blood glucose, often defined as over 180 mmHg, is consistently associated with worse outcomes after stroke. So while there isn't necessarily strong evidence that super tight glycemic control dramatically improves the primary neurologic outcome, it's definitely a standard nursing priority to monitor blood glucose and treat significant hyperglycemia, aiming for more moderate levels. It's part of optimizing the patient's overall physiological state. #TagTag V-exam, gotchas, and real-world traps.
All right, let's wrap with some common pitfalls, the kind of things that trip people up on exams or, more importantly, in real clinical practice. Test trick number one, the BP issue again.
Right. Scenario. Patient is eligible for alteplase by time, CT is clear, but their BP is 10/15. The team is scrambling. Do you give the drug while trying to lower the BP?
The answer has to be NO, right?
Yeah.
You have to get the BP below 185-110 first. Giving alteplase when the pressure is that high significantly increases the hemorrhage risk. That 185-110 is a prerequisite.
Exactly. Prerequisite. Trap number two. The time zero ambiguity we touched on. The wake-up stroke.
Patient went to bed normal at 10 p.m., found the symptoms at 6 a.m. It's now 7 a.m. Are they in the three-hour window?
Nope. Their last known normal was 10 p.m. the night before. They are well outside the standard 3 or 4.5-hour window for alteplases based on that LKN. Don't use the time they were found. Use the time they were last known to be normal. This is critical for eligibility.
Okay. That LKN rule is absolute. Final one. The clinical misstep of delaying the scan.
Yes. The patient arrives, seems stable-ish, but maybe has some atrial fibrillation on the monitor. Someone suggests getting a 12-lead ECG or drawing labs before going to CT.
Bad idea. The highest priority action is getting that non-contrast head CT or MRI. Why? Because every single subsequent major decision, especially the alteplase decision, hinges entirely on knowing whether there's blood present or not. Don't delay the scan for non-life-saving diagnostics. ECG, routine labs, those can wait until after the critical imaging is done. Time is brain.
Perfectly put. Okay, that was a whirlwind tour through the high-yield ACLS stroke essentials. Shall we try a super fast recall summary?
Let's do it. 2 minutes. What are the absolute must-memorize points if the stroke alert goes off?
Okay, rapid fire. One, the split. Remember, 87% ischemic, clot 13%, hemorrhagic bleed. Alteplase is only for ischemic, absolutely not for hemorrhagic.
Two, the time frame. LK1 is time zero. Get the CT and MRI done within 20 minutes of arrival. Aim for alteplase needle time within 60 minutes.
Three, the dose. Alteplase is 0.9 mg/kg. Max dose is 90 mg. Give 10% as a bolus over 1 minute. Infuse the remaining 90% over 60 minutes.
Four, The absolute NOs. Rule out hemorrhage on CT first. That's the biggest NO. And control BP to 185, 110 before giving the drug. Also, remember the three-month rule for prior stroke head trauma.
Five, the aftermath. After Altaplaz, keep BP 180-105 for 24 hours. And critically, NO antiplatelets or anticoagulants for that full 24 hours, get the follow-up scan.
Got it. 87-13 split. 20-minute scan, 60-minute needle, 0.9 milliquadrigram dose, max 90, no bleed, BP 185, 110 pre, BP 180-105 post, no other thinners for 24 hours. That covers the core.
If you nail those 5 points, you've got the fundamental framework for initial acute ischemic stroke management down cold.
Excellent. So for a final thought, what's something for our listeners to chew on?
Well, think about how the entire focus shifts if a large vessel occlusion, that LVO, is suspected early on. Suddenly, it's not just about the 4.5-hour Altaplaz window. It's about accessing EVT, potentially up to 24 hours out. This highlights the critical importance of regional systems of care, those different hospital designations, primary, thrombectomy-capable, comprehensive. The decision made by EMS about where to take the patient based on LVO suspicion and transport times fundamentally changes that patient's potential outcome long before they even hit the ED door. Pre-hospital triage isn't just logistics. It's literally a life or death pathway decision based on predicting the type of stroke and the required intervention. It really emphasizes how interconnected the whole chain of survival is.